Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Monday, December 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. defends its continued support of Israel's military operation in Gaza.
With Hamas still alive, still intact, and again, with the stated intent of repeating October 7th again and again and again, that would simply perpetuate the problem.
Egyptian Cat Palace on Sunday, on the first day of a three-day presidential election. A Zimbabwe analyst says the country is headed for a disaster when it comes to upholding multi-party democracy. A Sudan expert is cautiously optimistic about the latest news that the country's two warring parties have agreed to sign a cessation of hostilities agreement.
We need to see if Burhan is going to honor the commitments he gave before his peers, or is he going to follow the instructions that are outlined in the statement from the foreign ministries.
And the death toll from Tanzania's landslide caused by heavy rainfall rises to 85. Those stories by Samson Umali Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Amid growing criticism over its continued support of Israel's military operation in Gaza, the United States defended its stance on Sunday, but also reiterated the importance of protecting Palestinian civilians. Veronica Balderas Iglesias report.
More forcefully, with intensity. That's how Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu described Sunday the advances of his troops in Gaza.
In order to achieve all our goals, the elimination of Hamas, the return of all our abductees, and the promise that Gaza will never again be a threat to Israel.
Netanyahu also thanked the United States for vetoing a UN Security Council resolution last week that would have called for an immediate ceasefire. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken explained the decision when interviewed Sunday on ABC's This Week show.
With Hamas still alive, still intact, and again, with the stated intent of repeating October 7th again and again and again, that would simply perpetuate the problem.
As Blinken stressed the importance of providing Israel the support and weapons it needs to defend itself, he made it clear it is not without conditions.
Those rules apply to Israel as they do to any other country, including the way they're used and the need, the imperative, of respecting international humanitarian law.
But as the civilian death toll continues to rise in Gaza, the United States' stance has been strongly criticized at the Doha Forum, which is held every year to discuss world challenges. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtaya.
It's not up to Israel only. It is those who have given the Israelis the greenest of the green light to continue killing the Palestinians.
Ayman Safadi is Jordan's foreign minister.
In the United States, we had a very blunt conversation with Secretary Blinken. All of us, the Arab and Muslim delegation, were very clear. Our priorities are set. Stop the aggression, allow sufficient humanitarian supplies into all parts of Gaza, ensure protection of civilians.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, also a forum participant, said he'll continue appealing for a humanitarian ceasefire to be declared. And from Geneva, the chief of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, warned about the impact the war is having on the health environment in the Gaza Strip.
As more and more people move to a smaller and smaller area, overcrowding combined with the lack of adequate food, water, shelter, and sanitation are creating the ideal conditions for disease to spread.
He noted his organization has deployed teams to support health workers on the ground who are physically and mentally exhausted. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
A Sudan expert is expressing cautious optimism about the latest news that Sudan's two warring parties have agreed to sign a cessation of hostilities agreement. According to the Associated Press, General Abdel Fattah el-Burhan of the Sudanese Sovereign Council and the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF leader Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, reached the deal at Saturday's summit of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, Heads of State, in Djibouti. Suleiman Baldo is the director of Sudan Transparency and Policy Tracker. He tells me he's cautious because Sudan's foreign ministry issued a statement on Sunday saying that the IGAD communique did not accurately reflect the resolution signed by the heads of state.
I would be inclined to be a bit cautious because since the communique of the IGAD countries have come out, there have been further developments as we speak, you know, in the past few hours. And I'm waiting for confirmation development. But if this was confirmed, it means that Sudan is trying to wiggle free from the commitment that General Burhan has taken, and this would be a very odd situation.
What exactly do you think the developments are? Because according to this announcement, both sides are willing to sign a cessation of hostilities agreement.
This is indeed the case. Now, this is the official outcome of the meeting of the IGAD. However, 24 hours later, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Sudan issued a statement saying that the communique of the IGAD did not reflect the resolution reached in the Assembly of Head of State correctly, and therefore they were warning that the communique need to be corrected or otherwise Sudan would not be bound by the agreement.
What do you think the Sudan Ministry of Foreign Affairs could be referring to? According to this article, Al-Burhan had emphasized that any political settlement must involve the evacuation of civilian facilities and homes. Is that what they are talking about?
In front of his peers, Lieutenant General Burhan committed to agree to an unconditional ceasefire at a meeting, one-to-one with Lieutenant General Hemeti, the head of the Republic of Forces, for reaching a ceasefire unconditionally. While the statement from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs puts all the conditions that have led to the failure of previous attempts for ceasefires, which is the evacuation of capital by the Republic of Forces and other conditions that are basically indicating that there is no political will on the side of those who are speaking on behalf of Sudan to end this war. And by that, I am referring to the factions of the Islamist movement who are fighting along the Sudanese army. Imagine, James, that President Biden goes to a summit in Asia and signs an agreement with President Xi of China, and before his return to the homeland, then the Secretary of State and the State Department issued a statement saying that agreement reached with China binding, according to the foreign ministry. This is exactly what happened.
It doesn't seem to me you are optimistic a peaceful deal can come out of the IGAD summit.
Well, this is, as I said, these are events that are happening in rapid succession. It has been, a moment in which we believe the IGAD meeting was a real breakthrough in the negotiations for a cessation of hostilities and humanitarian access and possibly a permanent ceasefire. However, the statement from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs basically is putting all this in question. So we'll need to see if Burhan is going to, honor the commitments he gave before his peers, or is he going to, follow the instructions that are outlined in the statement from the foreign ministries.
Suleiman Baldo is the director of Sudan Transparency and Policy Tracker. He was speaking with us from Nairobi, Kenya. The head of the UN's humanitarian response in Sudan says the international body has only been able to reach a fraction of the nearly 25 million people needing aid in war-devastated Sudan. Clementine Nkweta Salami told the French news agency, the AFP, on Sunday that assistance to even those 4 million could soon stop if the chronic lack of funding continues. The UN's humanitarian coordinator for Sudan said the situation is catastrophic, 8 months into a conflict between rival generals that has torn the country apart. Many Egyptians headed to the polls on Sunday for the first day of a three-day presidential election in which four candidates, including President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, are running. Sisi, who has held the top post since being elected in 2014, is widely expected to win. The election comes as Egypt faces serious economic problems and outside pressure from the conflict in Gaza. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
A festive mood prevailed Sunday as residents in Cairo's upscale Zamalek neighborhood watched people lining up to cast their ballots outside a polling station. Observers from several political parties stood outside to keep tabs on what was taking place. Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly cast his vote in Egypt's new administrative capital early Sunday. The government built the new capital outside of Cairo and is trying to move its ministries and institutions there. Madbouly told journalists that he was pleased to be voting in the newly built capital, which was just a dream on a map not too many years ago. He says that hundreds of people are outside the polling station in the new capital, exercising their right to vote, adding, "We are all working hard to build a better future for our children and grandchildren." Egyptian state media showed President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi casting his ballot at a polling station near the presidential palace Sunday morning. Sisi has served two terms since he was first elected in 2014. A constitutional amendment passed in 2019 allows him to run for a third term. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that the three candidates running against President Sisi are weak. He says that none of the other candidates running against the president has much weight, so the election is more of a referendum on the president's popularity, and that given the current regional and international conditions, everything seems to be weighing in favor of Sisi's remaining in office. He says that the stability of Egypt remains important for the future of the Middle East region, and that no one really wants to see any disruptions in Egypt for the time being. Saeed Sadiq, who is a professor at Egypt's Japanese University in Alexandria, told VOA that the security situation in the country is weighing heavily on most voters' minds now and will likely influence their decision.
Before the 7th of October this year, the main issue was mainly economic. People were not happy with inflation, rising prices, rising foreign debt, which is over $166 billion. And then the 7th of October occurred with the idea that they will transfer Palestinians into Sinai. So the issue of national security began to overtake the economy.
Israel vowed to destroy Hamas, which governs Gaza, after the militant group sent fighters rampaging into Israel on October 7, killing around 1,200 people, mostly civilians, according to Israeli tallies. Hamas, which has been designated a terrorist organization by the United States, United Kingdom, European Union, and others, also took about 240 people hostage. Edward Uranian, VOA News, Cairo.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, December 11th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect us on all. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Something O'Malley Sports. A Zimbabwe analyst says the country is headed for a disaster when it comes to upholding multi-party democracy. This after the country's high court prohibited 14 members of parliament from the main opposition Citizens Coalition for Change, also known as CCC, from contesting their seats again in Saturday's by-election. Sigenzo Shabangu, who claims to be the CCC's interim secretary general, told the court that the parliamentarians no longer represented the party because they had been recalled. Tendai Ruben Bofana is a Zimbabwean social justice advocate and writer. He tells me the CCC will need to adopt a new constitution and create a proper party structures to prevent what he calls another imposter posing as an official of the party.
In a nutshell, what I can say is that the by-election was a complete farce. It was a complete sham. We cannot say we had an election when the main opposition was banned from participation. just a few days, I can say a day or two before the election, on Friday, we saw that the High Court granted an application by a guy called Stengezo Chabangu, who claims to be the Secretary General of the main opposition party, the CCC. The party has disowned him. They don't know him. They've never worked with him. They don't even have a position of a Secretary General in their party. And yet this guy was allowed to recall members of parliament who had been elected in August this year by the people of Zimbabwe.
What kind of organization is the CCC when a single individual like Chabangu can tell the court that the elected members of the CCC are no longer? How did that happen?
After the problems that they had 2 years ago with the MDC, when they formed this party, for some curious reason, they never had a constitution and they never had any structures within the party. Who's the vice president? Who's the secretary general? Who's the treasurer? They never had those. They say that they were doing that so as to protect their party from being infiltrated by ZANU-PF, the ruling party. But that didn't make any sense because that now effectively opened the door for imposters like Chabangu to come along and say, I'm the interim secretary general. But at the same time, the government is clearly following a certain agenda in disseminating and dismantling the CCC, especially in parliament.
Where do you think now Zimbabwe is headed in terms of multi-party democracy?
It's headed for disaster. In fact, there's a constitutional crisis as we speak. We cannot have elections which are constitutionally mandated. We had them in August, and now all those elected representatives are being recalled. Now that Chabangu can do this, you know, already we are going to have another by-election in February because he recalled more members of parliament. So now that he's been given this power, it means now he's just going to be recalling opposition members of parliament willy-nilly. So at the end of the day, it's quite possible that he's going to recall everyone from the opposition.
What options do you think are available to the CCC? Because the way you sound, it appears that Zimbabwe is headed for a one-party state.
I think the most important thing between now and February, when we are going to have the next by-election, I would strongly recommend that the CCC goes to Congress. They adopt a new constitution, not putting all their power in one person, but that is truly democratic. And at the same time, they elect proper structures that are recognizable so that tomorrow we don't see imposters like Chabangu coming along and claiming to have positions that they do not have.
Tendai Ruben Bofana is a Zimbabwe social justice advocate and writer. He was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. Tanzanian authorities said the death toll from the landslide caused by heavy rainfall on December 3rd in the town of Katesha, about 478 miles from the capital, Dar es Salaam, rose to 85 over the weekend. Government spokesperson Mombare Mateni tells me that the government is working to restore services to the affected areas.
So far, the number of deaths has gone up to 85. The total number of people who were actually taken to hospital, some were admitted, some were not admitted, since Sunday morning when the unfortunate incident happened, is now 133. Two of them have passed away. The rest have been allowed to go home, and 51 are still at the hospital. We also have a number of people who are still at the facilities where those who have lost their homes are being helped at is 322. The government is taking care of every social services. Telecommunications has been restored, power lines restored, roads, the main road is now restored. Some of the streets already restored, but we are still working on those roads, especially the small ones, small streets around that area. Water services has also been restored, and but the work is still ongoing. The government is also making sure that we don't have anything like pandemics in that area, so the water is being treated. Those people at the hospital, they have enough medicines. Those people at the camps, they have enough food. The security is there. Basically, I can say everything is going on very well. Now, the government is now working on a plan for resettlement.
In terms of the rescue effort, how far are you?
We are now in the final stages. We are probably close to the end.
So President Samia has visited the region.
The president visited the area to see what actually has happened, to console the people and to assure them that the government is with them at this difficult time.
I was reading an article about USAID, the United States Agency for International Development, also making contribution towards humanitarian assistance.
Yes, that's the case. $100,000 have been donated from the United States Agency for International Development. We are also having a lot of those humanitarian assistance coming in. Tanzanians have done a very good work on that. And actually, we're even now advising people that should probably change a little bit and focus on building materials, because these people will have to resettle.
Mumbare Matenye is the spokesperson for the Tanzanian government. He was speaking with us from Dar es Salaam. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the CAF Confederations Cup, as former champions RS Bakane maintained their impressive run in the group stages of the competition after securing another win when they played host to Durbels Noors on match day 3 of the group stages on Sunday evening. A first half goal by Yusuf Zahoudi in the 28th minute, coupled with an early second half strike by Mohamed El Marabit in the 54th minute, meant the Moroccans stretched their lead to an impressive 5 points in Group D with an impressive 2-0 victory at home. In Nigeria, clinical finishing by captain Nyima Nwangwa gave Rivers United of Nigeria a 1-0 victory over Club Africain of Tunisia on Sunday. Victory not only lifted Rivers to 6 points, it ended the perfect run of 2011 runners-up Club Africain in Group C. Group A leaders USM Algiers edged Modern Future of Egypt 1-0 in Algiers just through a 65th minute goal for Malian Abdoulaye Kanoe, his first of the African campaign. South African club suffered a disappointing run, with Sekwane United held to a goalless draw at home by Stade Malien of Mali in Group D, while SuperSport United lost 2-1 away to Al Hilal of Benghazi of Libya in Group A. The CAF Confederations Cup action resumes on Wednesday, the 20th of December, with match day 4 of the group stages taking center stage, as the race towards a place in the knockout stages continues across the continent. Staying with football news, CAF will award the honors of the Player of the Year on Monday in Morocco. Nigeria's Victor Osimhen, Mohamed Salah of Egypt and Ashraf Hakimi of Morocco have been named in the CAF Player of the Year final three-man list for the men's category. Nigeria's Victor Osimhen, who finished as the top scorer in the 2023 Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers, was instrumental in his club's Napoli Scudetto success last season, winning the Golden Boot after scoring 26 goals. Johnny Edwards is a sports editor for Punch Newspapers in Nigeria. He believes Victor Osimhen may likely pick the top player award.
Considering what he has done for Napoli and Nigeria in the year under review, having helped Napoli clinch the Scudetto the first time in 33 years, as well as also to helping Nigeria qualify for the Africa Cup of Nations, finishing as a top scorer in the qualifying series. So I think it's a good swap. He has done very well for Napoli. I mean, like I said, for club and country, compared to what Salah has done for Liverpool.
In basketball, the inaugural edition of the African Women Basketball League gets underway on Monday, 11th December, with 10 teams taking part in the competition. Previously referred to as the FIBA Africa Champions Cup for Women, the 9-day competition starts with a clash between Cameroon's University of Douala taking on Nigeria's Customs. And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, December 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barty in Washington, saying have a great week.